This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 2016, many people were shocked that Bob Dylan was awarded a Nobel Prize in Literature. This year, others were equally surprised that rapper Kendrick Lamar won a Pulitzer Prize for his music. So many think about literature as a kind of a highbrow experience, and these awards suggest a more expansive definition of high art. Our next guest says the worlds of literature and music have been borrowing from each other for years. Florence Dorr is a professor of American literature at UNC Chapel Hill and author of the book Novel Sounds, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll, and she joins us now. Florence, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
What about this? Because I think this is fundamentally a question about sort of the mingling of high art and popular culture, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I kind of became interested in this topic because in the first decades of the 21st century, a bunch of contemporary novelists were writing about rock and roll and sort of violating what seemed to be that that taboo that you've just described between high and low culture. And when I returned from writing an article about what I called the rock novel then, I went back to the book I was working on 1950s Southern fiction, and found that all the authors that I was examining had borrowed from vernacular culture for their fiction. So, for example, Flannery O'Connor titles a kind of paragon of Southern fiction, A Good Man is Hard to Find, which was written by an African-American bluesman in the first decades of the 20th century and then made into a hit by Bessie Smith. And so then kind of working further back, I was reading a biography of Leadbelly and discovered that John Lomax had brought him to the Modern Language Association meetings in Philadelphia in 1934, where he appeared, that is, Leadbelly appeared on a panel on popular literature that was actually chaired by a UNC professor in the Romance Language Studies department named Ralph Boggs. So then I started looking further into it and realizing, talking to medievalists who came to the conference that I held on this topic in 2016, and finding that, you know, Chaucer was actually taking vernacular ballads as a basis for some of his stories in the Canterbury Tales. So, yeah, it turns out the Kendrick Lamar and Bob Dylan wins are kind of a culmination of a long history, as you point out, of interlocking kind of overlaps between literature and popular music.
Well, we're going to get into some of the actual details, but let's assume that it's been going on for a long, long time, as you suggest. But there has been, what about the objection to it, the idea that we're trying to raise a wall, some kind of a barrier? Has that been a barrier that has sort of risen and fallen over time?
Sure. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the Coda and in another piece of writing that I'm doing now is that it does seem different, right? Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize and Kendrick Lamar winning the Pulitzer. These are unprecedented. And so it's not as if we're, we've always been celebrating this overlap. But I do think there was a time when we forgot that vernacular music was a part of literature. And that the institutional divide between high literature and low culture has been kind of obfuscating, and that these recent wins, I guess we're more willing to look at it at the moment.
And you talked about specifically Southern writers. Was this a Southern thing to some extent, so the idea that Southern writers were more likely to embrace vernacular?
Well, yes and no. I think that Southern writers, so one of the arguments that I make in the book is that Southern writers were institutionalized for the first time in 1950s because of their imagined link to vernacular music, right? So Faulkner, Cleanth Brooks, in the first book-length study on Faulkner, said in 1963, just a little bit before the Beatles arrived and appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, in kind of promoting Faulkner as one of our best writers, he said, "What could a provincial possibly have to say in the age of nuclear power and electronics?" So it's a way that, in a way, they were trying to link Southern writers to kind of Appalachian illiterate communities, and they liked the fact that Faulkner had dropped out of school, and they're like, "See, look, Southern writers are more literary because they have this connection to vernacular music." African-American writers in the 1960s, whether from the South or not, were also very interested in using vernacular music in their fiction, but to a really different end. So there's a scene, for example, in Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, where this kind of debased character sings spirituals in order to get money from white people. And so it's a kind of Sambo figure, actually, that Ellison laments the use of black vernacular music in that way. So it's a really different relationship to ballads, but people are using those ballads in all kinds of different regions.
And in your book and in your research, you're talking particularly about music because we know, for instance, 19th century romantic composers were all about finding vernacular music to incorporate in their music. They were trying to find national identities through folk dance and raise it to the kind of courtly status of high art. And we know that writers have been using vernacular speech, Zora Neale Hurston, to name one, who ran afoul of Baldwin and others just for that very reason, right? I mean, they were angry at her for saying, no, we're trying to tell the white people we don't talk like this. And she said, no, I must. But that's everybody staying within their medium. Now, you're saying they've switched genres here.
Right. And I mean, and Zora Neale Hurston's a really interesting case, too, because she went, like Lomax did, into rural communities to record vernacular voices, and herself sang, learned the songs and sang them and recorded herself singing them. She had a relationship with John Lomax. There's correspondence that exists between them. But to your question more directly, I think that Southern writers, these white Southern writers, you know, who are being touted as America's finest, partly because they were white, and this is an era of desegregation, and there was a lot of objection to that, that they were finding recourse to Southern ballads partly because of the emergence of rock and roll and partly as a kind of overlapping cultural zeitgeist, right? So they were kind of being touted as backwards vernacular oral form. And in their literature, they're kind of flouting that characterization, that designation, by aligning themselves with rock and roll, by producing electronics in their fiction, or a kind of what I call a machine realism that opposed the aesthetic for which they were being championed.
Give us an example of that, because there's a way in which you can also be a sort of literary in an ethnomusicologist kind of way. In other words, you go in as an anthropologist writing about the fact of it, you know, the Tom Wolfe kind of thing,
right?
Or you're actually embracing it. It becomes part and parcel of your style.
Well, I think, Flannery O'Connor is a really good example, right? Because she's this, old Southern white lady. And her, she has in that story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, she has her grandmother character do this kind of characteristic oral story, a tall tale from the South. But her story is about a Southern gentleman who tries to court her, and he leaves his initials in a watermelon. His name is Edgar Atkins Teagarden, and it spells eat, and he leaves it for her on her porch every day. And an African-American child happens by in this tall tale and reads it and eats it, right? So I actually think that that scene kind of links the story to the tall tale of the grandmother to A Good Man is Hard to Find, because she ends up not marrying this guy who turns out died wealthy because he had invested in coke stock when he was a young man. But that there's a way in which her story is kind of like A Good Man is Hard to Find. And so she's, rather than kind of distinguishing herself from the machine arts in the moment, she's kind of embracing a connection by titling her story after that Bessie Smith hit.
Let's just listen to that song a little bit and talk more about the way in which the music finds its way into, in this case, Flannery O'Connor's work.
My happiness is less today. My heart is broke, that's why I say, not a good man is hard to find. You always get another kind. Yeah, so when you think that he's your past, you look and find him fooling around some old gal, then you're
Bessie Smith, A Good Man is Hard to Find. I'm talking with Florence Dorr, author of Novel Sounds, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll, book launch party, and concert tonight on the roof of the Durham Hotel. There's going to be some music along with that. But let's talk more about this because, again, this is a title that Flannery O'Connor chooses, a direct reference to a blues song that I think by then many people would have been familiar with. So she's hoping this song is ringing through your ears.
It's got to be. Right. She claimed to Sally Fitzgerald, the person who put together her short stories for the and wrote the introduction for her collected works. What she said is that she first heard the song sung by a little girl in a newsreel who had won some contest or something. So by then, it had been a hit 25 years earlier or so. So yeah, it's sort of in the national consciousness. And this is where kind of historical work, when you're studying literature, comes in kind of importantly handy in that you sit down to read the story, and I didn't know this the Bessie Smith song the first time that I heard the read the story. But if you actually listen to the song and then sit down to read the story, it feels really different. And it's sort of the song haunts the story in a way.
What do you think it was about this period? I mean, you talked a little bit about the fact that there's a backlash against the effort to desegregate. Mm-hmm. What else is going on in this moment to push writers to write like this?
So I think a lot of different things. The 1950s was kind of a big era, obviously, a big push for globalization. It's the beginning of what's, you know, what we're seeing the end of now, the American century, in many ways. And so I think that we had seen New England writers as the kind of best writers emblematizing American literature at the time. The question of why Southern authors become American writers of that moment, I really think has something to do with a desire to withdraw from globalization and, you know, racial integration and the rise of computer technology and all the massive ways in which America was kind of developing. And I do think Rocket 88 being the first rock and roll song, according to some, that was ever written and recorded, you know, this black man singing about an Oldsmobile and about, you know, darting around and mobility. I think that Southern writers were meant to, or the institutionalization of Southern literature in the 50s was meant to sort of bring us back from that. So it was a sort of a gesture of withdrawal.
But it's interesting. It's a retreat into something else that is a kind of beyond the limits, right? I mean, it's beyond the pale. I mean, it's almost embracing then black culture to have to.
Yeah, well, that was not part of the intention. One of the arguments of the book is that as they were being held up, these white authors as exemplifying America, and, you know, partly because it's sort of guaranteed whiteness through a link to ballads, these writers are producing incredible racial ambiguity in their novels. And that's kind of one of the, you know, jokes on the institution that Southern writers were playing.
Now, a lot of the music you reference, when you talk about Lead Belly and now we got Bessie Smith, these are kind of roots songs that are rooted in ballads, Delta blues, a folk tradition. Rock and roll is a little more self-conscious than that. It's a bit of sampling, cultural sampling itself, right? So how does that play a role? Because, again, that's not, I mean, there is no pure form, but it's sampling, I suppose, the best example.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that what I find kind of interesting is that, you know, those genres that you mentioned, blues and folk and, you know, country, amalgamate and join to become this hybrid form, electrify and become this hybrid form, which is rock and roll in the 1950s. And what I'm suggesting is that Southern writers are doing the same thing. Right, they're bringing those same older forms into the 1950s and presenting them in this new aesthetic form and being self-conscious about their electrification, about the fact that they are market forms and technological forms in order precisely to flout this idea of Southerners as provincial rural people. Flannery O'Connor does reference one rock and roll song in a later work, The Lame Shall Enter First, which is, I think, from 1964, Shake, Rattle, and Roll. And a big Joe Turner hit. Elvis Presley covered it, and Bill Haley as well. But there's a really awful character in the novel, or in her story, who, in order to taunt a boy whose mother has died, puts on her mother's nightgown and sings Shake, Rattle, and Roll, sort of like making monstrous rock and roll forms.
Right.
So that, I think, is sort of a later phase of this, right, where you're actually portraying rock and roll songs. But in the earlier moments in the 1950s, they're doing what rock and rollers were doing, which is just taking these older vernacular forms and remixing them and repurposing them for something else.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, is this also an American thing? Is there anything about the sort of democratization of art that is unique to America or that we'd find it? I can remember interviews with people like Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris, mm-hmm. who are Irish actors, and they talked about breaking in, and these British directors, when they began, would utterly dismiss them. They were totally, you know, sort of ethnically racist toward them. And they thanked American cinema and Hollywood for allowing vernacular to make it into the film industry.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is kind of characteristically American. And that, you know, on the other hand, I mean, you point out to the 19th century composers looking for folk to validate their high art. And so Herder, I mean, you know, going back to folk and fairy tale collection, right?
Right.
That those are European practices as well. I should also mention Cecil Sharp was a ballad collector who came to North Carolina in the 20s along with his assistant Maud Karpeles at North Carolina, Tennessee, the Appalachian Mountains to collect collect British folk ballads from the Scottish and British Isles to see if they had remained unchanged, which many of them remarkably had. So it is what you're describing is, I think, American, right? The sort of embrace of the vernacular in the 1950s as representing American culture, but it's also linked very much to a kind of volkish European tendency
to define culture, because the nation state is defining itself, it's what does it mean to be German? There's no such thing. There never has been. Now we've got to come up with it. And so
that's
the Brothers Grimm say, well, you know, we always told these stories. That makes you German.
Uh-huh.
Did it work the other way? Do we see music then becoming informed by literature?
It's a good question. And I don't know. I mean, I think probably you could say that that's true, like with Dylan, right? I mean, Steve Earle told me at the conference last year that Dylan is when rock and roll stops being about cars and girls, to put it in Steve's words. In fact, I'm censoring one of his words. And I think, you know, for a lot of musicians of his stature, Dylan winning the Nobel Prize made sense because for him and for other people, that's when literature or rock and roll became more literary. So that's one marker for that. But, you know, Peter Guralnick, who was at the same conference, objected to that and said, you know, that Chuck Berry was just as literary. And that may be true, but Dylan seems, I guess, more directly connected to the you know, the beats and stuff in New York and in the Village, so that there may have been more direct connection.
And take 60s. Us back, because this began with a conversation about Lead Belly and his going to a literary conference being brought by Ellen Lomax, right?
Yeah. I mean, so was Lead Belly then influenced by literature? I don't know. I think
Well, I mean, the other way around. I guess I'm flipping directions on you again.
Yeah.
What was his influence on, or what was the literary content of his work, and why was he brought to?
He was brought because he was seen as creating living literature in that cultural sense that we were just describing. And so people were kind of like, look, this exists in America. And so we have something that's like Beowulf. They, you know, compared him to Beowulf. So that's fascinating. Yeah.
All fascinating stuff. Florence Dorr, a professor of American literature at UNC Chapel Hill, author of the book Novel Sounds, Southern Fiction in the Age of Rock and Roll. 6 o'clock tonight, Florence is going to bring her husband, Will Rigby, of the 1970s power group, by the way, the DBs. They're going to host a book launch party and a concert at the roof on the roof of the Durham Hotel. Florence, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find links to her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a rare trove of dinosaur eggs, 97 million years old. They're in North Carolina. We'll tell you how they got there and what it's going to mean to research when our program continues. Stay tuned.